Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined as always by Frank Calcagliano. How are you doing this week, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. I'm doing great.
Are you finished with your marking?
Just about.
Okay.
And I think now I have about 20 references to write.
Right. Okay. I think you and I are in the same boat there, where you're near the end of the semester, or at least the middle of the exam diet. So, in the news this week are all kinds of foreign policy stories. North Korea, Iran, the Jerusalem embassy, and it appears as if President Trump is in the process of radically remaking American foreign policy. And we can think about, in the last 18 months, he's pulled out of the Iran deal. He's opened up negotiations with North Korea and has a planned summit with North Korean leadership, pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement, pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade agreement, moved the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. I guess that was today. Imposed steel tariffs. I heard this morning that we're stopping aid to South Sudan. So it seems like a radical refiguring of American foreign policy. And so we thought we'd talk about what kind of antecedents we have for such a radical shift in the ways in which the United States relates to the rest of the world.
Renegotiating NAFTA as well.
Oh, yes, to be sure. Although that's
threatening to
pull out. Who knows? But this, I think in some ways it seems this whole panoply of things that Trump has been doing seems somewhat unprecedented. I mean, what examples come to your mind, Frank, about presidents who have gone into office and said, right, I'm here now. We're going to do things radically different than how we've done things in the past.
In terms of foreign policy, David, not that many strike me. I mean, when we were chatting about this before recording, we came up with three, none of which are entirely great or fit perfectly. The three we came up with were Jefferson, Polk, and Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
So we'll take a minute and talk about those. But to start with Jefferson, since he's my guy...
And you, of course, are the author of the definitive work on Jefferson's foreign policy, which, of course, all our listeners have purchased and dog-eared. But
I think definitive would be an overstatement, but that's kind of you to say. I mean, Jefferson, when he was elected in 1801, his election represented a shift in foreign policy. So over the course of the previous decade, when the Federalists were in power, U.S. foreign policy, the biggest question facing the United States were the wars of the French Revolution. And to put things in a complicated situation rather simply, the Federalists tended to be more pro-British in their orientation, and the Jeffersonian Republicans were more pro-French. And when the Jay Treaty was negotiated in 1794 and ratified over the course of the next year, that became a bit of a cause celeb for the Jeffersonian Republicans. They saw it as too pro-British, and the United States was orienting itself or aligning itself too closely with Britain, effectively re-entering the British Empire in economic terms. When Jefferson was elected, he allowed a lot of the provisions of the Jay Treaty to lapse. There's some analog there, I suppose. Although the provisions were expiring, and he simply allowed them to expire. His foreign policy was more pro-French, certainly, than that of his Federalist predecessors, Washington and Adams. So in that sense, it represented a change. The slight hesitation you might hear in my voice is a result of the fact I wouldn't want to overstate this. It was more a change, a difference in emphasis rather than a kind of U-turn in American foreign policy. And I think what we've seen recently in the things you've mentioned that President Trump has done in the past 18 months have been much more radical changes and we'll get to this, I guess, reflect a desire to undo some of the policies and achievements of his predecessors, particularly his immediate predecessor, Barack Obama. I don't think Jefferson works entirely well for that. I think it's a shift in emphasis rather than a U-turn. Does Polk help us anymore?
Well, I have a question about Jefferson that maybe you can help me make sense of. Because one of the questions that came up in the early Republic, and you understand this far better than I do, was after the French Revolution, the question is, the United States has had a treaty, an alliance with France from the American Revolution. Does the treaties and does the alliance continue after the French Revolution? And I remember there being a debate between the Federalists and the Jeffersonian Republicans about whether they should continue to be allied with France because of this agreement, or whether that ceases as soon as the French king ceases to have a head. Which seems to have some similarity with some of the things going on now with, the Trump administration saying, well, you may have had an agreement with the last administration, but that's the last administration and they're gone, and we create our own deals.
Well, that's an interesting...
The question sometimes with foreign policy is like when political change happens, whether that's a decapitation of a king or election of a new president, is the relationship between one, set of politicians and another set of politicians, or is it between two nation states that continue even when political order changes?
That's a really interesting analogy, David, and a really good question. You're absolutely right. So the Federalist position in the 1790s, after the execution of Louis XVI, was the alliance the United States made was an alliance with Louis XVI. And once Louis's regime was overthrown and he was executed, that alliance no longer existed. The Jeffersonian position was, no, this was an alliance between the United States and France.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that France is now a republic actually strengthens that alliance. It was always a slightly awkward thing that the United States had allied with a monarch.
An absolutist
monarch. For that matter, in order to win its independence from a constitutional monarch. So it was a little awkward. And the argument that Jefferson made was, no, the alliance of 1778 was an alliance between the United States and France.
Mm.
And therefore, it persisted. Whereas, you're quite right. I mean, John Adams and George Washington would probably be rolling over in their graves at the thought of us making this connection, but Trump's foreign policy to some extent saying, no, is with this, the previous regime is gone, now it's another one, would be more in line with their understanding of at least where France was concerned in the 1790s. I hadn't made that connection. I appreciate you raising it. So that's an interesting analogy. That's a very interesting analogy. One of the problems, I think, is that as far as the rest of the world is concerned, and the way the world works, nation states enter into agreements, and those agreements are meant to transcend domestic political considerations.
Sure.
And you can't kind of unpick every agreement every time there's a new regime or president in power.
Yeah, and having a new president is a radically different thing, if you pardon the pun, between that and decapitating a monarch and replacing it with a very different kind of government.
That's right. That was the overthrow of a regime and its replacement.
Yeah.
Trump's election may seem radical and revolutionary to us by comparison with what came before, but it was a legal election according to the Constitution, and there will be another one.
And the general premise is that these kinds of relationships persist after elections happen. So thinking about like other examples of presidents that have tried to remake foreign policy, from the 19th century, obviously they're usually not deeply interested in foreign policy. But one example that comes to mind is President Polk, and part of that is Polk ran on a largely on a foreign policy platform. He wanted to annex Texas, which had become its own country, as Texas always reminds us they were once their own country. And he also wanted to push for U.S. occupation of the Pacific Northwest. He, in doing so, was a significant break from his Whig predecessors, who were trying to take a fairly conservative line on both the Texas question and on their relationship with Great Britain. And Polk comes into office and says, right, we are going to, first annex Texas. They actually annex Texas after his election, before he even takes office. And then he proceeds to position troops on the Texas border with Mexico to, as most sort of skeptical historians think about it, with the purpose of instigating a war with Mexico in order to defeat Mexico, in order to take half of its country, which ends up happening. And picks a fight with Great Britain, threatening to wage war to occupy the Pacific Northwest, and ends up sort of bullying Great Britain into a treaty to extend the 49th parallel border all the way to the Pacific Ocean. That's a situation where he is in some ways running on foreign policy and is marking a very distinct shift from at least his immediate predecessors two of the big foreign policy questions of the day. Frank.
But, I mean, I agree with you on that, but isn't Polk's difference one of means rather than ends, in the sense that his predecessors were also committed, at least theoretically, to American expansion?
To be sure.
And so the difference is, I mean, you're right, he's much more bellicose. He's going to provoke a war with Mexico, and he threatens to wage war against Britain in order to negotiate. But it's a difference of means rather than ends, I think.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I mean, the position of the Whig Party through all this was that the United States shouldn't wage a war against anybody, that, you know, annexing Texas is going to lead to a war with Mexico, as it did. And, you know, the Whigs were in favor of diplomacy over warfare with Great Britain. They had just signed a treaty with regards to the border in Maine in 1842. And so when, you know, Polk gets elected president, it is a meaningful shift, though, I think, in terms of the, you know, foreign policy stance the country takes towards a sort of militant expansionism instead of a sort of diplomatic expansionism.
Ask a question about Polk, similar to the one you asked me about Jefferson, to make an analogy to what President Trump is doing. What do you think of the following argument? And this is not necessarily my view.
Okay.
Polk was successful in terms of achieving his two ends, which was the annexation of Texas, and ultimately, because of the Mexican War, the acquisition of all this territory, additional territory in the Southwest, but also in negotiating a fairly favorable border in the Northwest, favorable to the United States, with Great Britain, because of his willingness to go to war.
Yes.
Some supporters of President Trump's, and those who, the kind of people who've nominated him for a Nobel Peace Prize, for example, in Congress, his supporters, have argued that President Trump, because of his bellicosity and unpredictability, is largely responsible for bringing North and South Korea together, and the summit meeting with Kim Jong-un that'll be happening in Singapore on June 12th, and that these achievements are because of his Polkian, if I may use that expression, kind of aggressive rhetoric.
Wow. I'm curious if these put those two guys in a room, what they would think of each other. Polk was making a gamble, I think, in his foreign policy. I think, you know, annexing Texas, the placement of the U.S. troops on the border with Mexico to the purpose of instigating a war with Mexico, all of that could have gone disastrously wrong for the United States.
United States could have lost the Mexican War.
And the ways in which the United States expanded into, you know, an occupied half of Mexico in some ways set the preconditions for the Civil War. Polk, of course, didn't know that. The situation with Pacific Northwest could have gone badly, too. And, you know, from the U.S. perspective, Britain could have ended up with Washington and Oregon if they had pushed their, southern claims for occupation. The consequences, if Polk's adventures had gone badly, wouldn't have been that large, though. The cost, barring the loss of Mexican and Oregon, not having the entire western half of the United States, whereas then today the consequences of, you know, rolling the dice on sort of a bellicose posture are so profoundly different in terms of the loss of human life possible, the ways in which, you know, the destabilization of the international order could lead to World War III, or something short of that that's equally horrible. You know, it's so delicate and so complicated in a way that diplomacy wasn't in the 19th century. And diplomacy in the 19th century was complicated, but I think we're on a whole sort of another level of complexity now that, you know, does require, I think, a very careful hand to be able to navigate it. And you know, Polk was dealing with two levers, with Mexico and with Great Britain. You know, Trump now is dealing with 200 levers in the world, and trying to sort of calibrate those properly is profoundly difficult. And I'm worried not only that he's not keep up to it, but also that the what's left of the State Department isn't up to it.
I agree with what you've said. I think the differences are pretty profound. Mm-hmm. And I worry that he hasn't necessarily given the attention to the complexity of the Korean situation that he should. I mean, I hope he does so in the next month, in preparation for the summit meeting. One crucial difference is, of course, in the 19th century, the United States is a minor to middling power. Mm. So its ability to make mischief is quite profound in its own neighborhood.
Oh, to be sure.
But it's not that mischief doesn't necessarily have global consequences in the 1840s. It has profound consequences for Mexico, for British North America, for mm-hmm. indigenous people in North America, but that's it. Whereas, as you say, the consequences of a miscalculation or getting Korea wrong or Iran wrong are quite quite profound.
Or getting Israel wrong.
Yeah,
or getting
globally. So I think that's different. And we factor in the new the difference in technology. We're talking about nuclear weapons mm-hmm. now, as opposed to, you know, when Polk sent troops to the Texas-Mexico border,
yeah.
they were carrying muskets, effectively.
Yeah.
it's a different world in that respect, and that's really, really important to bear in mind. But I do think there is something, as I said, Polkian about Trump's bluster and rhetoric, whether he realizes that or realizes the stakes he's dealing with. I can't know. I don't know. I'm not certain.
Well, I think he very much values this rhetoric of strength and power being the overriding virtues of foreign policy. And strength and power, you know, isn't necessarily that the finest. Those are clubs, not surgical instruments. And I think you often need surgical instruments to deal with foreign policy effectively.
So our third example is Jimmy Carter.
Who is the antithesis, if you will.
He's the anti-Trump.
Well, because Carter, in some ways, like Trump, comes into the presidency with no foreign policy experience. He had one term as a governor of Georgia. But he
served in the Navy.
Served, to be sure, but he didn't have any active,
right, sure.
being in the Navy and having active foreign policy experience are, you know, not the same thing. But he campaigns very much on positioning the United States differently in how it conducts foreign policy. He says, look, we need to prioritize living up to our democratic values. We need to prioritize human rights. I found this interesting quotation from his first year in office. He says, "For too many years, we've been willing to adopt the flawed and erroneous principles and tactics of our adversaries, sometimes abandoning our own values for theirs. We fought fire with fire, never thinking that fire is sometimes best quenched with water. This approach failed with Vietnam, the best example of its intellectual and moral poverty. But through failure, we have now found our way back to our own principles and values, and we have regained our lost confidence." And his basic supposition was the United States should stop allying itself with dictators and tyrants. And, you know, and if you're looking at he's looking back at the long history of U.S. foreign policy going back really to the beginning of the Cold War, in which the United States had repeatedly sided with pretty ugly political actors around the world, because the political actors that these awful people were fighting against communists, and if they're fighting against communists, then they must be on our side, and we should therefore support them in their activities. And Carter looks at that and says, that's not justifiable. The United States needs to back democracy, it needs to support human rights, it needs to speak critically not only to our enemies, but also to our allies when they don't sort of live up to the principles of the UN Charter and the Declaration of Human Rights and what have you. So they speak very critically of South Korea, for instance, which was very, it was very critical of political opponents in South Korea. The United States had backed a number of really ugly governments in Chile, in El Salvador, in Uganda.
In Iran.
In the 50s, the United States had, overthrown a democratically elected government and replaced it with a tyrant, and we had done that in a number of places. Carter tries to reformulate U.S. foreign policy along these kinds of moral values. Carter, of course, is a Southern Baptist. He's someone who's very much moved by his faith and, has a very clear moral compass, or at least projects that. And we can look back at Carter's foreign policy. Well, how effective was it to actually shift gears in this way? What does it mean to sort of abandon, or at least, to say, to Pinochet in Chile, or to say to, leaders around the world, like, okay, we were supporting you, but you're really not living up to our values. We're going to change gears. And some people have looked at Carter's foreign policy in some ways as a failure, or made significant failure, because he wasn't, in some ways, he only alienated the people who were our friends, but didn't actually make any new ones. We can only look at the situation in Iran, where, in some ways, the U.S. foreign policy in Iran only exacerbated some of the animosity at least a segment of the Iranian people had against the United States. What are your thoughts on Carter's foreign policy?
Well, a couple of things. The first thing I'd say is it's not just foreign policy where Carter represents a radical shift.
Sure.
I mean, basically, Carter's presidency is a response to Watergate.
Yeah.
And what had immediately gone before him, the presidencies of Richard Nixon and the brief presidency of Gerald Ford. And that manifested itself in foreign policy as well. I think you're right. The one thing to be said, there's a narrative of failure around Carter's foreign policy that's taken root in the discourse on both the left and the right in the United States. I mean, both the Democrats and the Republicans, unsurprisingly, but also the Democrats, have kind of subscribed to this. And for a long time, Carter was kind of persona non grata in the Democratic establishment as a post-president. Bill Clinton had a difficult relationship with Jimmy Carter. Didn't want to be associated with him because of the taint of failure that Carter allegedly brought. Having said all that, Carter's is the one presidency since 1941, I believe this is true, where no American soldiers, during which no American soldiers were killed, nor fired shots in anger at anyone.
What about when they tried to rescue the hostages?
Well, because the rescue didn't work, they didn't actually come into conflict with anyone.
Okay.
So that is the crucial. If the hostage rescue had worked to the extent that they had tried to rescue, they didn't get that far. So that's the slight qualifier there. And of course, the United States maintained its military presence around the world during the Carter presidency,
sure.
A kind of unofficial empire of military bases that the United States has. However, Carter's presidency is an oasis of relative peace and calm,
sure,
in what, in foreign policy terms, since 1941 or 1945, depending on where you want to pick your start date, basically every single presidency has been characterized by considerable bloodshed and mayhem around the world.
Or threat of bloodshed.
Right, but didn't happen during the Carter years.
And I think Carter actually, when I give him credit, tried very hard to create, use American power to try to create the framework for peace. And probably the most famous example of that is, you know, the Camp David Accords, where he gets together Israeli and Egyptian leaders, you know, which would fought two wars against each other very recently, and was able to negotiate at least an opening of diplomatic relations between those two countries.
That's right. And Carter has pursued a career as a kind of international peacemaker since then.
The other big foreign policy step that he takes very early on in his presidency that earned him a great deal of ire was pushing towards returning the Panama Canal, or giving, you know, maybe returning may not be the right word, granting control of the Panama Canal back to the people of Panama rather than having it be a military occupation by the United States. And that was a step that was, on a moral level, the right thing to do, because the United States basically stole that piece of land from the people who lived there 100 years, 75 years prior. But on the other hand, it got him a great deal of resistance from both Democrats and especially Republicans in Congress.
Yes, indeed. I guess with regard to Carter's foreign policy, again, he's the anti-Trump in a lot of ways. Mm. So while his foreign policy does represent a not necessarily a radical change, it's more about means again. Mm. So saying, okay, let's try something different. Let's try to live up to our ideals. Mm. It was in the direction of increased diplomacy, increased alliance building. The results were, as you've suggested, and I think correctly, mixed.
Yeah.
But his is a very, very different... His shift represents a very, very different foreign policy than that we've seen from President Trump thus far. Which is interesting because when he was running for president, Trump sent some mixed signals. He said, we need to get out of these wars in the Middle East. He was always talking about renegotiating trade deals in ways that I think have proved to be unhelpful. But he did signal a possible shift away from a more bellicose foreign policy. In practice, that hasn't been the case.
Well, in fact, he tried to position Hillary Clinton as being the hawk.
That's right.
In the campaign. It's very hard to obviously assess that a coherent rhetoric from him or a doctrine from him on foreign policy.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, do you think there's a Trump doctrine?
Not that I've been able to figure out yet. But before we sort of figure out this what's going on right now, we've got these three examples, but the other 40 people who have occupied this office for the most part have not massively shifted gears with regard to foreign policy. Why do you think that is?
Well,
why is it when somebody takes office, why doesn't this happen more often? Why doesn't, isn't there a shuffling of the deck as soon as a new president?
Well, that's a good question, David. I think, in the first place, the United States is, the American president is not a monarch.
Hmm.
So he, and ultimately she, does not have the authority necessarily the tradition hasn't existed of shifting foreign policy. There's been a sense that, whoever occupies that office is doing so temporarily and should uphold existing agreements and so on. And that has been the rule rather than the exception for most of the history of the presidency. We should really focus, I think, on the 20th century and onwards, really since the Second World War, because to some extent with the rise of the imperial presidency and the national security state and the importance of the United States as a superpower, the circumstances are, that's perhaps more germane than looking back further. Foreign policy is not that important than that for most of the 19th century, to a large extent. I think there are institutional reasons for it. The Trump presidency, the importance of the State Department and the size and scope and scale of the State Department has ensured that there was a permanent group of bureaucrats and administrators, and I don't say that in a pejorative way, of public civil servants
is
perhaps a better way to frame it.
Knowledgeable people.
Yes, in posts who maintain the status quo, that is, maintained and acted as curators and caretakers of existing agreements. It's been widely reported that the State Department under Rex Tillerson and now Mike Pompeo has been gutted, and a lot of career diplomats have resigned or lost their jobs as a result of the Trump presidency. And so there is an the same level of kind of institutional memory, and I think that's an important factor. The other thing I think that's occurred, and this is not unique to Trump, although we're seeing its the consequences of it playing out under President Trump, is the Senate no longer ratifies treaties the way it once did.
Mm.
So if you think about the Paris Accord or TPP or the Iran deal, these are big achievements of the Obama administration. Well, none of those were submitted to the Senate for ratification. Under the Constitution, the Senate has the authority to ratify treaties. I think the reason for this is because of the rise of partisanship.
Mm.
So President Obama recognized and knew that there was no way a Republican-dominated Senate would ratify the Iran deal.
And
as a consequence of this, he pledged that the United States would uphold these and appropriated funding and acted as though the treaty was in force. Mm. These treaties were in force, and that worked. And I think he did so in the hope that once they took root, they wouldn't be uprooted. And in most cases, that's how things have worked in recent decades. But the problem with that is, in kind of working around the Constitution because of for political reasons, and again, this isn't unique to President Obama. I think this has deeper roots than that. That does make it possible where somebody like President Trump comes in, he can reverse those decisions because they weren't ratified as formal treaties. And I think that's a problem. So I think there are institutional reasons, both in terms of the decline of the State Department under President Trump in the past couple of 18 months, but also this longer standing issue that the Senate hasn't exercised its authority and given these treaties the power of law.
Well, I mean, there's some areas where this sort of, you know, who the president is, there are foreign policy things that do sort of flip-flop with every presidency. I mean, one example is U.S. support for birth control internationally. Where when a Republican's in office, they say, no, we're not funding birth control. We're only funding abstinence-only education on a global scale. The Democrat takes office and they totally switch gears. And then they, you know, flip-flop as whoever's in power. One thing that strikes me, though, is that, you know, presidents very rarely run on foreign policy. You know, thinking about domestic campaigns are primarily about domestic policy. That's what people vote on. That's what people campaign about. And oftentimes presidents end up getting ensconced in foreign policy when they're in office, but it's usually not their first, you know, priority. If you think about George W. Bush, talked very, very little about foreign policy when he was running for president in 2000. And the one thing he did say was that we're not going to get involved in nation building. And, you know, a year after he's in office, that's all, you know, out the window. And that's true, I think, for most political actors, because the American people, for the most part, aren't deeply versed in foreign policy, nor do they, really drive their votes. When politicians, though, sometimes do position themselves during the campaign as saying, look, I'm going to change policy in North Korea or Iran or what have you, oftentimes what happens when they get into office is they don't do that. And sometimes that's because somebody from the State Department comes in and says, Mr. President, I know you campaigned saying you were going to engage in multi-party talks or bilateral talks or whatever. We're going to shift policy in some way on some country. Here's why doing that's a really bad idea. And in most cases, the president says, oh, I didn't fully understand that. And they keep, you know, the tendency very much is to sort of allow the career diplomats to maintain their, the existing policy. So this is a very much, I think, a shift from that very long tradition. And the thing I'm worried about is looking forward. I mean, okay, so if what's going to happen in the next election or the election after that, when a new person is in the White House, what's going to happen with U.S. foreign policy? To what extent are we entering an era where potentially U.S. foreign policy is going to shift with every new administration? Or is this going to become the new normal?
I mean, I think this is a possibly a topic for a future podcast.
Mm-hmm. And listen, in 4 years, when we have a...
Well, we've proved repeatedly that we're better at the past than the future. At least I have. I do wonder whether there actually may be a reversion to the norm after the Trump presidency in either 2 years or 6 years' time, whenever it's over. Because so many norms have been violated, challenged in so many ways that we may actually, we may revert to the norm. And so there may be more continuity in foreign policy in the long run than seems likely at the moment, but you know, who knows? Time will tell in that regard. I think your point is a good one, though, and I think your concern is a real one. I mean, and in this, as in so many other ways, we're in unprecedented territory, or totally new territory. A kind of variation of that, which is interesting, is, of course, once last Wednesday, when President Trump announced that the United States was pulling out of the Iran deal, which, of course, involves more than just the United States.
But involves
our European allies, China, Russia, and so on. President Obama issued a fairly lengthy statement on Facebook criticizing and critiquing this decision. And that, too, is unprecedented to a large extent in the modern history of the modern presidency. There's a long tradition, because they know how difficult it is, that former presidents don't criticize the current president, even if they disagree with their policies. Mm. And President Obama broke with that tradition last week. I think of all the precedents that have been set and norms that have been challenged, that's relatively minor in the grand scheme of things, but I did think that was interesting.
Yeah.
What did you think of that statement?
Well, I think it was... I think historically it's extraordinary. I mean, obviously, the usual trope of the presidency is that once you've left office, you retire and you open up your presidential library and you say banal statements and show up and be supportive when necessary, recognizing that's an extraordinarily hard job. That, you know, and even if you disagree with the particular choices the person's making, you don't criticize them, at least not in public. You know, one of the things that strikes me, and I'm worried about at the moment, one of the many things I'm worried about, is, you know, the ability of the United States to engage in foreign policy is in part predicated upon the fact that we are going to be an honest broker. You know, the United States has a reputation for, at least, with the treaties that it's signing with foreign nations, living up to the terms of its agreements, and making promises and keeping them. Now, you can sort of parenthetically say, if you look at the history of treaties with native peoples, the United States doesn't come off so well in terms of its willingness to stick by its deals. But at least with non-native treaties, the United States has, at least in the past century, lived up to its obligations. You know, I think the ability, the willingness of other countries to engage in trade agreements or in diplomatic agreements of any kind, it's going to be very, very limited if people worry about, okay, is this going to be valid in 2 years when somebody else is in office? Because the standard heretofore has always been that, you know, these agreements exist between countries, not between particular sets of political leaders. If you look at, like, the Iran deal, the supposition in the Iran deal is that there's these protections in case Iran doesn't live up to its end of the deal, about inspections and making sure that if inspections don't happen and all these kinds of things. There isn't anything in the Iran deal about what happens if the United States or Britain or the rest of the EU or China doesn't live up to its part of the deal, because the supposition is in the deal that those countries are going to behave responsibly, at least on this particular kind of agreement. If the United States starts backing out and changing deals every few years, making future deals is going to be very, very difficult. I mean, I'd be hard-pressed to imagine Iran right now saying, oh, we'll get a new deal and we'll have a different deal with the United States, because I don't think they think the United States is going to live up to its end of the bargain. So I think it tremendously damages the credibility of the United States as an actor on the global stage, that we're backing out of deals that we had made simply because the person in office doesn't like them.
I agree with everything you've said, and I share your concern. I think one thing that perplexes me about the decision about the Iran deal is, in a month's time, Trump has to negotiate, is going to negotiate with North Korea over nuclear weapons.
The exact same kinds of issues. I mean, yes. The situation is very different in some ways, but it's very similar in others.
And he seems to have undermined his position by doing just what you said, and therefore one could argue that North Korea and Kim Jong-un would say, why am I making a deal with this guy if it could be repudiated by his successor?
That's right, exactly.
So he seems to have undermined his position there slightly, and I think that's right. The other thing we've seen is a diminution of U.S. influence. So I believe it's today that France, Britain, and Germany are meeting to work out their own strategy with respect to the Iran deal and with respect to Iran. And they're meeting not just without the United States, but in opposition to the United States. Yeah. Not because they seek a breach with the United States, but because they recognize that at the moment, at least, the United States can't be relied on. And that's an extraordinary development, given how close U.S. relations with those three countries, both collectively as part of NATO and part of the European Union, but also as bilaterally with each of them, have been since the 1940s. Whether this is a permanent shift or not, again, remains to be seen. It depends on who President Trump's successor is.
Well, and I think if you look at the 20th century and the way the United States has been able to serve as a broker between different countries, whether that's in the former Yugoslavia, whether that's in Northern Ireland, the ways in which the United States has come in and said, look, where we can help both sides agree to some kind of mutual beneficial situation or resolution to conflict, thinking back also to Carter and the Camp David Accords, that role is predicated upon, a kind of a stability and consistency in U.S. policy that seems to be out the window now. And I find that deeply troubling. And it seems very much, as you point out, like Germany is now assuming on the global stage that role in a way that the United States used to.
Well, two things I would say, and then we should probably wrap this up.
Yes.
I think you used the word seems twice in that sentence. So it does, when we're in the midst of these moments, it is difficult sometimes to appreciate the longer-term consequences, and we don't know. So it may be that that's how it seems at the moment. But whether that remains the case remains to be seen. Mm-hmm. The other thing I would say is Germany's in a very interesting position because it's relatively reluctant to take on this role. Germany is an economic superpower, and Germany is the most important country in the European Union and one of the most important countries in the world globally, but it actually doesn't have the international influence commensurate with that potential power and that economic significance because it doesn't have the military power to back it up. And for obvious historical reasons, it's reluctant to exercise that kind of power. So Germany's in a slightly challenging position. Britain's in an interesting position because, of course, it is it's a medium-sized military power that often exercises undue influence and outsized influence because of its connection with the United States. But, of course, it's leaving the European Union. Its place in the world is up for grabs right now and uncertain at the moment. So there's a great deal of uncertainty between and among the U.S. and its traditional allies at a time when the world is in a very uncertain and precarious position. And I share your concern about that.
Trump is very
much... We can only hope for the best. We have to wish. I believe it's well established over the 50-odd episodes of this podcast that we're probably not President Trump's biggest fans. But one has to wish him success in these talks with North Korea next month.
I'm very much hoping we're deeply wrong about everything we say about, in our critique. Because I think if we're right, then that's not a good... that's not in bode well for the future.
Yeah, let's hope we're in a position where he wins the Nobel Peace Prize and his supporters are crowing over it.
Well, and he wins it and deserves it, right?
Right.
We'll see when that happens.
I'm holding my breath.
No, he's an agent of chaos, and I think what you want in foreign policy are really boring, knowledgeable bureaucrats talking to each other in very calm and measured voices. And yes, that's not his bag.
You want the adults in charge when it comes to foreign policy.
That's for sure. All right, last drops, Frank.
I would like to recommend a Twitter feed, and that is the Twitter feed of Jennifer Mendelsohn.
Okay.
He's described as a resistance genealogist.
Those are not words I usually associate with one another.
Ms. Mendelsohn has, over the past year or so, done a lot of genealogical work, particularly with regard to the backgrounds of people involved in the debate over immigration, like Stephen Miller in the White House. Sure. And so on. The reason she's come to, she's received a great deal of media attention over the past few months, but over the past few days she came to the fore again and was in the news because she did some genealogical work on John Kelly, the White House Chief of Staff.
Yes, who made some very incendiary comments earlier this week.
Yeah, well, yes, he did, about immigrants and how they're not suitable and so on and they don't have the skills. He also recommended, he seemed fairly blasé about removing children from their mothers and fathers, the children of so-called illegal immigrants. And in response to this, Jennifer Mendelsohn just pointed out, the facts matter, that Mr. Kelly's antecedents in the early 20th century, who came from both Ireland and Italy, like my own, were illiterate. And worked as day laborers and had very humble origins themselves. She wasn't doing so to criticize. She was simply pointing out that because Kelly had made comments about people coming with only a fifth or a sixth grade education and they're not qualified to do jobs and so on.
And they're from rural areas and they can never...
rural areas and don't speak English. Well, it turns out his Italian and Irish antecedents were exactly the same. And Mendelsohn does, actually, I think, good work pointing this out. She also pointed out that Tommy Lauren, who's a bloviator on Fox News and the internet, and is a quite right-wing opponent of immigration, that her antecedents didn't speak English and may have come to the United States illegally and so on. And again, this isn't to point people out for shame. And if you look at her Twitter feed, it's very interesting. She points out, this is true of her own antecedents as well, but more or less to point out the kind of immigrant history of the United States. It's a great Twitter feed. I think it is doing a public service as well, and I think we should all support resistance genealogy.
And the genealogist will save us.
David, what's your last drop?
Well, I'm excited about a new book that it just came out last week. I've ordered it, but in some ways it's not a new book because it was originally written in 1931. And it's by Zora Neale Hurston, the famous novelist and anthropologist and writer. And it was actually her first book about, based on a series of interviews she did with one of the last survivors, maybe the last survivor of the Atlantic slave trade, who lived in Alabama. It's a book called Barracoon. And originally when she wrote it, the publisher said, no one's going to read this. It's written in dialect. And so it's been sitting in an archive for the past 80 years, and now has seen the light of day. And so it's one of an exciting new but old story that we're getting to look at for the first time.
Excellent. Who's publishing it? Do you know?
It's a big New York press. I don't remember which one, but I'll put a link.
Is it? But it's a trade press.
It's a trade press. Right. Yes. Excellent. Yes. Excellent. Yeah.
Good.
Right. All right. Cheers.
Cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.